Right, so we're going to move on tonight by looking at Matthew chapter 6. And I believe I speak for us all that the last couple of weeks, particularly the thoughts from verse 38 onwards of Matthew chapter 5, have been very difficult for each and every one. Not necessarily difficult to understand, although there's been a certain amount of difficulty in perhaps trying to express them properly and clearly, but I think we've all appreciated the difficulty of actually living them. The Lord is obviously putting on the requirements which he wants to see in his disciples in the very everyday matters of human life. And I'm sure as we've considered the things that he's had to say, we've looked at our own lives and see how miserably we fail. And therefore, when we come to chapter 6, and principally right down to verse 18, the Lord then almost even intensifies what he has said up till now. Because he's almost opening up in chapter 6 with the assumption that it may have been possible that we have lived in our lives all the requirements which he has set down for us in Matthew chapter 5. That we have upheld all those principles and to the very best of our ability have been able to perform that which he has requested of us there. And therefore, with that thought in mind, he almost offers a warning in chapter 6 and verse 1 when he says, take heed that you do not your alms, you margin, righteousness before men, to be seen of them, otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. I've always considered, up to recently, that the alms he is speaking about in verses 1 to 4 was basically giving to the poor, you know, giving alms before men. The Revised Version underlines the fact that he means more than that. Literally, the Revised Version gives the word righteousness. Take heed that you do not your righteousness before men to be seen of them. The Diaglot renders it religious duties. Jerusalem Bible puts it as good deeds. And there's no doubt in my mind that what the Master is saying, take heed that all the things which you have performed in your life, which I've been speaking about in Matthew chapter 5, that this righteousness which is now part of your very being, that you do not do before men to be seen of them. And I think the key phrase there is to be seen of them. Because what we've considered in Matthew chapter 5, if they are demonstrated in a person's life, can make someone appear to be very religious. And the problem is, they might enjoy being religious. They might want to show off before their fellow men what good people they are. And therefore their righteousness is shown before men to be seen of them. And the Master wants us to make sure that we are performing his will for the right reasons. That our motive is quite clear. If you go back to chapter 5 and in verse 20, remember when we were looking at this, I say unto you, except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So the Master is trying to express that our righteousness, our right deeds, our good things that we perform must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And then in chapter 6 and verse 1 he says, take heed that you do not your righteousness before men to be seen of them. So if we're to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, if we are to perform that which he has requested of us, as we've been looking at in Matthew chapter 5, how is it possible without that being seen before men? I think he explains himself very clearly when we look at verse 2 to 4. He says, therefore, when thou doest thine alms, Do not sound a trumpet before thee as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy right, left hand know what thy right hand doeth, that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly. Now, although he doesn't mention them, I believe that the hypocrites that he is referring to in verse 2 are none other than these scribes and Pharisees. Because as the word hypocrite means, it means a play actor. And like any actor in any professional or amateur production, he is performing an act. For what reason? That he might win the applause and praise of men. Now all actors, particularly amateur, but even so I suppose the professionals who are doing it for money, they are very concerned what the reaction of their public is going to be. And therefore they want to perform to the very best of their ability in order to achieve the praise and the applause of men. Therefore if they have 10 curtain calls, it demonstrates that they have put on a very good performance. If the critics the next day, in writing in the paper about that play, give them rave reviews, then they believe they have performed well. And the Master is saying there is a danger of doing that in your religious duties. That you are play-acting the part so that you can win the approval and gain the applause of men. And the Pharisees were dead hands at that. Everything they did was calculated for the maximum effect on those with whom they had to do. Therefore, in verse 2 he says, do not sound a trumpet before thee as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and in the streets, that they may have the glory of men. Now the Master on other occasions speaks of the Pharisees wanting to wear their long, wonderful clothes. They wanted to have the applause of men. They wanted the uppermost seats in the synagogues. In everything they did was to demonstrate how religious they were. You remember the parable of the Pharisee and the publican? When the Pharisee boasted, Lord, you know, I have fasted twice in the week. I've performed this good deed and I've performed that good deed. And the publican says, God forgive me, a sinner. Now there was no questioning the motive of the Pharisee. He'd done it, but he hadn't done it for the right reason. He'd done it to gain the admiration of his fellow men. He liked to be highly thought of, what a religious person they are. And his reward was the applause of men, that he could be highly thought of as being the pillar of their religious society. And the Master says, when you perform it, when you are carrying out my will in putting into practice those things of Matthew chapter 5, remember, you're not doing it to get the praise of your fellow man. You're doing it for the glory of God. And therefore, don't exhibit your righteousness so people will say, what a good person they are. How marvellous that they have done this, that and the other. And therefore, we gain the admiration of men. And therefore, I believe that the key phrase of verse 1 is to be seen of them. And of course it is very, very vital that we understand this, because the Master goes on to say, otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. And the implication is you've received your reward. You've been seen of men, you've gained their admiration, their applause, and therefore that in itself is your reward. Don't think you're going to get a reward of your Father, because indeed what you are doing is for your own glory and not for his. Now if we just go over to chapter 7, I think we shall see this clearly in chapter 7. Look in verse 21. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name have done many wonderful works. And I don't think there's any denying the fact that they had. But the Lord's comment in verse 23, then I will profess unto them, I never knew you, depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Because it was not to the glory of God, but for themselves. And therefore they were performing his will to their own ends, that they could have the praise and admiration of their fellow man. And the Lord wants us to be aware of this situation, that because we may have struggled to appreciate and to live those things which are contained in Matthew chapter 5, it could almost come to the point, and if I may use a colloquialism, and please don't misunderstand me, that we feel so self-righteous, we're almost polishing a halo as we do these things to our fellow man. And the Lord says, if you're doing it for that reason, your reward is instantaneous. You've had the praise of men. You will be rejected by me and my Father, because you are not doing it for the right reason and for the right motive. And there are three things he wants us to consider here in Matthew chapter 6. First of all, in verses 2 to 4, is our worship in relation to men. Notice in verse 2, therefore when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do. So he wants us to consider this aspect of what he is demonstrating before us. First of all, our worship in relationship to our fellow man in doing these alms. Then in verses 5 to 15, he wants us to consider these aspects in our relationship to God, because he talks about prayer. Look at verse 5. When thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are. So first of all, in verses 2 to 4, it's don't show your alms as the hypocrites do. And then in verses 5 to 15, it's don't pray as the hypocrites do. And that's our relationship towards our God, the way we worship our God. And then in verses 16 to 18, he speaks about fasting. Moreover, when you fast, be not as the hypocrites. And that's our worship in relationship to ourself. And each time, so that we understand the sections, don't be as the hypocrites are. Verses 2 to 4, in relationship to other men. Verse 5 to 15, in your relationship to God through prayer. And in verses 16, in relationship to yourself, in fasting. And he wants us almost to demonstrate what our true motive is in performing his will in these three things. But I think we've got a dilemma, brothers and sisters, to contemplate first of all. Can we just go back to chapter 5 and verse 16? Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. That's what Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16 says. Let your light shine before men that they may see your good works. But then in chapter 6 and verse 1, take heed that you do not your righteousness before men to be seen of them. So how can you, on the one hand, being performing the will of God so that the truth, the light of his word, is seen of men, when in chapter 6 and verse 1 he says, take heed that you not be seen of men in doing these things? Well, I believe, as I'm sure we all have contemplated, but it's right for us to underline it, it's a difference of attitude and motive. Look at verse 16 of Matthew chapter 5. The whole aspect of verse 16 is to glorify your Father which is in heaven. That's the whole aspect of verse 16. That what we are doing it unto God. It's not for self-esteem. It's not for self-importance. We are not worried what others are thinking of us in our performance of God's will. Everything is being done to his honour and to his glory. Whereas in chapter 6 and verse 1, the emphasis very much is to be seen of men. That what we are doing is for the maximum effect so that others will notice what we are doing. That the utmost thing in our mind is to promote ourselves and how good we are and how religious we are and what a lot of work we do for the Almighty and how wonderful we are in our dealings with others. It's for the maximum effect to be seen of men. The second thing that I'd like us to consider is, if we look at the whole of Matthew chapter 5 as we have done, if we are to express that in our life, it's the expression of God's love. Because of what he has done for us, we have seen each and every time we are expressing our thanks and our gratitude and our love for him in performing his will. So what we have got in chapter 5 is an expression of God's love towards others. Whereas when we come to Matthew chapter 6, what the Master is saying, I think, is totally different. Can I just enlarge on what I mean from 1 Corinthians chapter 13? Now we know chapter 13 is the whole chapter which deals with love. In the Authorised Version, it's charity, but I'm sure we all understand. It's that word agape in the Greek, which is this deep, very reverential, sacrificial type of love. The love which God has shown towards us, which we are commanded to show towards one another. And I'd like us to read from verse 1 of 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not love, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long and is kind, and so on and so forth. Can we just think about verse 3? Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, it is more blessed to give than to receive. The whole aspect of the Lord's teaching is that we should give. Remember Matthew chapter 5 last time. Verse 42, give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. So the Master is instructing us to give our goods to feed the poor. We're exhorted constantly to be cheerful in giving. And yet Paul says, I can give all my goods to feed the poor. And still it's wrong. I can give my body to be burned. I can be a martyr for his name's sake. I can suffer persecution to the ultimate limit of laying down my life. And Paul says, if it's not done in love, then it profits nothing. Now comes the point which we've got to reconcile and clear in our own minds. How do we know we are doing it in love or not? Now one could take the simple answer by saying, well, those who obviously are of the world, who give to the charities of the world, and we've got people like Sister Teresa, who obviously has given her body, basically, to help others. She has given everything that she has for the help of others. And we've got many hundreds, yea, thousands of people to demonstrate how kind and holy and righteous and religious they are. They have shown their righteousness before men. It's very easy to say, well, that's wrong, because they don't know the truth, and therefore they're not doing it in love. Don't think it's as simple and as straightforward as that. I think we've got to appreciate that people are moved and motivated to try and help others because they generally want to help. So how can we ensure that what we are doing is being done with the right motive, it's being done in love, and more importantly, it's being done to God's glory? Because to my mind, there's a very fine dividing line, a very, very fine balance between doing it for the wrong motive and doing it for the right one. Now, if I can take you to 1 John chapter 4, let's see if we can exercise our minds a bit more. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another. Love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that knoweth not God, for God is love. In this was manifested the love of God towards us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. Verse 7, love is of God. Verse 8, God is love. What is John telling us? That love is a divine attribute. It is not something which by nature we possess. So that the true love which the scripture speaks of can only be developed by understanding and appreciating that love is a divine characteristic, is a divine attribute, and that we are wanting to display that in our lives. Without appreciating that, there is no possibility, says the scriptures, of any man or any woman inherently being able to manifest this true, genuine, agape love. Now we may, from a natural point of view, have love one towards another. But as we know, from the scriptural point of view, it's the Greek philia, which is this tender affection. Or it can go even further and can be the Greek eros, which is a very sensual, sexual type of love. The desire one for another. That's got nothing to do with this love which the Lord Jesus Christ is speaking about. The one has to be assimilated, it has to be understood as a divine attribute. And it's only when we are willing to display that characteristic in our life that we begin to understand and appreciate that of ourselves we can do nothing. Everything that we are doing is because of God. And therefore we are doing it not to give us any praise, because obviously we didn't have this attribute in the first place. It's because something that we have developed because of our love for him. And even then, John wants us to appreciate something. Verse 10. Herein is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us, and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. We genuinely can never say we love God, we wanted to perform his will, and therefore because of our obedience he has come to love us. It's completely the opposite way round, says John. He loved us, and he was willing to give his Son that we who were enemies and strangers from him might be reconciled, for us to appreciate the love that he has shown. And in recognition of that love which he has shown, we want to do his will. And we want to display his attributes and his characteristics in the lives that we live. Knowing it's not of ourselves, it's the gift of God. So when we come back to 1 Corinthians 13... you look at verse 4 to 7. Love suffereth long, is in kind. Love envieth not, love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, and so on and so forth. We could go to Galatians chapter 5 and other places, and we find that the things of the flesh are completely opposite. Those things which by nature we possess are the very opposite of what love is. And therefore, by only appreciating the qualities and the attributes of God, can we demonstrate in our lives what true love is all about. It's something which by nature we do not possess, and by nature we will never ever be able to display. We might be able to do acts of kindness. We may have the sensual love one for another. We might have tender affection in a neighbourly sort of way. But these real, religious, deep, spiritual attributes of love can only be assimilated, understood, and then demonstrated in our lives. They come from God. So the one is an expression of God's love in our lives. The other is so that others will love us. And I think that's the key when we come back to Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1. It's whether we want people to love God or whether we want people to love us. Because the one is being done to his glory, the other is being done for our own. The one is that he might be glorified, the other is that we may be seen of them to receive our reward from them. Good Master, what good thing shall I do to inherit eternal life? Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one. At the gate, beautiful, Peter, James and John were there to raise the man who was crippled. He said, silver and gold have I none, but such as I have I give unto thee. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. We cannot of ourselves claim anything in what we are doing. We are doing it because we want to do his will. And the Master says, he will then reward you secretly. Now if we come back to chapter 6 and verse 2. Let's just look at verse 2. When thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have the glory of men. Verily, I say unto you, they have their reward. Now, whether the Master had got something specific in mind, I don't know. Some have suggested that the trumpet was a long, convoluted collection box, which was used in the temple, which when people threw of their abundance in, it made a huge clattering of noise so that people could demonstrate how generous they were in giving to the money of the treasury. I don't think it means that at all, because the Master says in the synagogues and in the streets. He doesn't speak about the temple. I think he's just using a simile that things are done for the maximum effect. Now again, I'm not going to criticise and I'm not going to undermine the work that's been done over the past few days and weeks for giving for children in need. But one of the things which is wrong is that they are seen of men. Their pledges are publicised. Look at how much I have collected and what I have done. Now when we looked at Matthew chapter 5 and spoke about giving, the whole object of it was that we do it secretly. We do it anonymously. We don't want people of their abundance to give, and the poor widow of her last mite to feel, you know, insignificant, and that what she is contributing is of no consequence. Everyone has to be the willing giver. And therefore I think it's right in our community that we have collection bags and not plates. Now in the churches, you know, the plate is the normal thing, because they are seen then to make sure it's a £5 note or a £10 note. And therefore somebody who sadly can only give a pound feels very awkward that he is not giving as much as the person next door. In our collections, we obviously want to seem to be doing it privately. that we are not seen of men to, you know, be seen to be giving. Obviously that doesn't excuse us, so that people don't know, therefore we don't have to give as much. And as one brother once said, the reason we don't have plates is that people won't take their change off it. I mean, that's not the spirit of it at all. The whole object of it is that we are not be seen of men to know what we are giving. And here, obviously, the hypocrites, which I believe he was referring to the Pharisees in verse 2, were not really giving, they were selling. Or putting it another word, they were buying. They wanted to buy the praise of men. They wanted to sell their religious acts so that they get their reward. And they got paid for it there and then on the day when people said how religious they are, how wonderful it is to do so much for other people. And that's what the Pharisees wanted. And therefore, whatever noise, whatever show, whatever demonstration they'd got to do so that people could see what they were doing, and therefore they would maximise the effects, that's what they were prepared to do. They were not pleasing to God. Their motive was completely wrong. Let's go to John chapter 5. Look at verse 43. I am come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. If another shall come in his own name, him you will receive. How can you believe which receive honour one of another, and seek not the honour that cometh from God only? And they wanted to receive honour one of another, and not to seek the honour that cometh from God only. And I think we all have to think of our own attitude, our own motives, why we are doing certain things. Is it to be seen of men? Is it to win their applause? Is it to win their praises? Or are we doing everything genuinely, honestly, to the glory of God and giving him the praise that is due? Now, obviously, such is the nature that we are bearing. It is very difficult sometimes to separate the one from the other, because we all like praise. We all like to be thanked. We all like to feel that we have done something good. But again, it comes back to analysing our own conscience. Things. Is it to be seen of men? Is it to win their applause? Is it to win their praises? Or are we doing everything genuinely, honestly, to the glory of God and giving him the praise that is due? Now, obviously, such is the nature that we are bearing. It is very difficult sometimes to separate the one from the other, because we all like praise. We all like to be thanked. We all like to feel that we have done something good. But again, it comes back to analysing our own conscience and our own motives. Why are we doing things? Why are we in the truth? Why are we performing these things? Why do we do anything in the service of God? It is for his glory and to repay in some small way what he has done for us. So we are demonstrating his love to others to appreciate the way he has shown his love towards us. Now, when we come back to verse 3 of Matthew chapter 6, when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. Now, in one sense, you know, it's almost impossible if we're doing something on the left hand for the right hand to know what we're doing, and vice versa. Again, what I think the Lord is implying here, that we are not seen publicly to give, that we are not seen publicly to perform our religious duties, that we are doing it so that it's done unto the Father and not for this maximum effect. In other words, you are not giving openly. Now, if I can bring this back, brothers and sisters, to, let's use the idea just for a moment, that it's actually giving of money. I don't think that's what's implied, like I've said. I think it's the whole of our lives before God, our religious duties, the things that we do. But let's just think of it, just for a moment, about giving. Can we go to John chapter 13? Last Supper, Judas Iscariot is about to go out and perform his deed. And when the Master has sort of pointed him out as being the one who would betray him, in verse 29 of John chapter 13, some of them thought, because Judas had the bag, that Jesus had said unto him, "Buy those things that we have need of over against the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. Now, to the best of my knowledge and research, that's the only reference I can find in the whole of the life of the Lord when he makes reference to giving of money. He was to pay tribute to whom tribute was due, but actually giving to help the poor, I can find no record at all in the life of the Lord where he actually was seen to be giving money to the poor. There are many occasions when he helped the poor and needy, when he raised people from the dead, and so on and so forth. But this, to my knowledge and research, and I look forward to any thought you might have later, where there is an actual reference that money was collected by the disciples on behalf of the Lord, that they might give something to the poor. Likewise, when we go to Acts chapter 20, although on many occasions the Apostle Paul exhorts us that we should make collections for the poor, you remember when he speaks about the poor Jews which were in Jerusalem, and they should give generously so that they may be supported, and all the other things which Paul has to say, we come down to verse 34 of Acts chapter 20. Well, verse 33 for connection. "I have coveted no man's silver or gold or apparel. Yea, ye yourselves know that these hands have ministered unto my necessities and to them that were with me." And again, that's the only reference I can find, which again is more by implication than actual, of where Paul was helping, literally, others financially. Now, I find that if it's true, and as I say, I've done as much research on it as I can, that if it is true, we have got no public demonstration in the Lord's life or in the life of the Apostle Paul when they were be seen to be giving. Now, I believe they both did in abundance. I believe they gave of their want to help those who are poor and needy. Now, we know the Lord could obviously, by miracle, provide food and that, but I also believe he would help the apostles to show this generous spirit and this willingness to give to others. And yet there is no public demonstration of that. Now, if we go back to the First of Chronicles chapter 29, I believe their attitude and that of all faithful followers is seen in the First of Chronicles in chapter 29. Remember the words of David. Verse 10 of 1 Chronicles 29. "Wherefore David blessed Yahweh before all the congregation, and David said, Blessed be thou, Lord God of Israel, our Father forever. Thine, O Yahweh, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and in earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom of Yahweh, and thou art exalted as head above all. But riches and honour come of thee, and thou reignest over all. And in thine hand is power and might, and in thy hand is to make great and to give strength unto all. Now therefore, O God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name, but who am I? And what is my people, that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort, For all things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee. And David said that on thanksgiving for what he'd been able to do in assembling the riches for the building of the temple, a house for God. Now he could genuinely have said, you know, I have done all this for your sake. I have given of my riches, of my wealth, of my glory. But he doesn't. He said, it's all yours. And all things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee. Now I believe that attitude is expressed when we come back to the Gospel of Matthew. I'd like us to come back to chapter 25. We've already seen in chapter 7 that those who are rejected the judgment seat say, Lord, we have done this in thy name, and in thy name we have done many wonderful works. And what about all the money we have given to the poor and all the other things that we have done in thy name's sake, for thy name's sake? But in verse 37 of Matthew chapter 25, then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, or took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? When saw we thee sick or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. Now I believe both Matthew chapter 7 and Matthew chapter 25 had done these things. I believe those rejected had done the many wonderful works in his name. But they were conscious of it, they were aware of it, and they'd done it for themselves to demonstrate how religious and good they were. Here in Matthew chapter 25, these righteous were not aware that they had performed these acts. They were not aware that they had demonstrated in their life God's love. And I'd like us just to think, and can I give you an illustration so that we can test it on ourselves? No doubt you've got many which you can throw back and discuss later. Think of last week. Think what words you said, what acts you performed, as far as your husband or your wife or your children were concerned. The natural things which went on as part of everyday life. And I would suggest that the vast majority of us could not remember all but the odd detail. Because it's just part of our natural way of life. We don't think about the things that we have done. We don't think about the pocket money, or we don't think about the good deeds that we have done, all the rest of it. Because it's part of our natural life. It's just come something as part of our very nature, our very being. Now the Master is saying that likewise is your spirituality as well. Can you remember genuinely all the good deeds that you have done for the Ecclesia? All the good deeds you have done in visiting the fatherless and the widows? All the good things you have done in giving to the poor? And all the other things that we've been contemplating, Matthew chapter 5, can you remember them? Are they vivid? Are they stark? If they are, then we're counting them up. We're pleased and we're proud of what we've done. And the Master says, if that's the case, and you're conscious and aware of what you are doing for my name's sake, you are doing it for your own benefit, your own reasons. In other words, it's not part of our very being. If we're not expressing daily these things which the Lord has demonstrated in showing our love one to another and to all those with whom we have to do, then we have not fully appreciated, any sense of the term, what Matthew chapter 5 is all about. Because it's almost like the ledger which many have used on exhortations, that we are saying we've done that good deed for him. Oh, the readings, that's another tick. Oh yes, and I've done this and I've done that. And we're counting up to think that's to our credit. And the Master is genuinely, I believe, saying, if you are recording them in your own minds, if you are saying, well, I've done so much this week, let somebody else have a go next week, then our motive is totally wrong. We have got to be doing it that we're almost unconscious of the fact, that we're not aware of it. Lord, when saw thee naked and clothed thee? When were you in prison? If I'd have known that, if I'd have remembered that, what I would have, of course I would have remembered to come and see you. Something you've done it unto the least of these, my brethren, unconsciously. You haven't been aware of the fact. Then the Master says, you have fulfilled my will. You are doing these things for the glory of the Father, not for any praise of yourself, not to show to others, look, yeah, he's been and visited that sister 4 times. Now again, brothers and sisters, we've got to balance it up. It doesn't excuse us for not doing it. The Lord wants us to do it. The Lord wants us to perform his will. He wants us to put into practice all these wonderful things. But we should do it as part of our very being. There should be a natural, if I can use that term, progression in our lives. It's not something, like again, brethren have used in exhortation, religion is not something we put on with our best coat on the Sunday. And we put it off on Sunday night so we can live the rest of our lives unto ourselves. It is very part of our being. We cannot differentiate between doing God's will and our own. Now all I'm saying, because I put myself to the test, can I remember all the things that I did last week from a natural point of view? And can I then remember them from a spiritual point of view? And if we can vividly remember, oh, I remember going to see Sister so-and-so, and I remember doing my readings every day. If there's so much forefront of our minds, then there's a problem. The Master is saying, the righteous will say, Lord, well, when did we see you like that? When did we do these things? We were doing them every day because we wanted to do God's will. Can we come back to Matthew chapter 6? He now wants to talk about prayer. In verse 5, when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray, standing in the street, in the synagogues, and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. And secondly, in verse 7, when you pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do. They think they shall be heard for their much speaking. So first of all, 2 warnings. First of all, about praying openly, and secondly, about long, repetitious prayers. Now again, he is not saying he doesn't want us to pray. He's saying we should pray always. He wants us to have prayer constantly on our lips. But he says in verse 5, don't be as the play actors, who do it for effect, who do it to be seen of men. And secondly, in verse 7, again, don't use vain repetitions for the same reason, that they might be heard for their much speaking. Now again, brothers and sisters, it's interesting in verse 5, that one of the practice amongst the Jews, and it's still today, they have set times of the day when they are to pray. It goes back originally to their law that they should pray morning and evening and at midday. The psalmist uses that very phrase. We find Daniel, if you recall, was praying towards Jerusalem at a set time. And people knew that he prayed at that set time. So it was part of the Jewish way of life, the Jewish custom, that whenever the time was, they had to stop everything to pray. Now, in one sense, I think it's a marvellous discipline that we are conscious that 9 o'clock or 12 o'clock or 3 o'clock or whenever the set time is, we are then giving God due thought and due reverence. Because I speak for myself, sometimes we're caught up with the hurly-burly of the day, and we can almost go the whole of the day and not think of him. So it's a very good discipline that the Jews had to make sure they prayed at these set times. And no doubt we've seen on the television sets that same principle has been taken up by the Muslims, that we see them every so often prostrating themselves fully on the floor and praying towards Mecca. They likewise have set times to do it. But verse 5, what the Master is saying, the Pharisees so orchestrated their day that when these set times occurred, they were always going to be on the street corner. It was not coincidence they were there. They were there to be seen of men. When suddenly the hour was and they were seen on their knees praying unto their God, and people would say, what religious people they are. We see today with their skull caps on, the Wailing Wall, chanting to themselves. And people get the impression they are being very religious. And they orchestrated their day, that they were always on the street corner. And that's the point which I think is quite ironical, if I can use that term, in verse 5, in the corners of the streets. It was not just in the streets, it happened to be on the corner, so that they could be seen at least in two directions. So it wasn't just that it could be seen in the street they happened to be. They had to be on the corner so they could be seen that way. And if it was a crossroads, they could be seen four ways. And everything was done to the maximum effect. So people could say, very religious. Now again, if we adopted that at work, in one sense it's a good discipline. But we're doing it for the wrong reason. We're doing for the sake of others that they can say, well, they're very religious, everything stops that they can sort of pray to their God. And we're doing it for the wrong motives. We're doing it to be seen of men. And the same in verse 7. Use not vain repetitions. Now again, the Pharisees adopted a principle which again had become a custom of the Jews. They believed that prayers ought to be repeated. But to show off their knowledge, they had certain texts, certain quotations, certain phrases, which they used at these set times, but they repeated them 22 times. And each one started with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And they used the same phrase and just changed the beginning slightly, so that they repeated the same phrase 22 times, beginning with a different alphabet. And they used the basis for that of Psalm 119, where, as you know, the use of the Hebrew alphabet is seen throughout that psalm. And so when the set time was there, the Pharisees were not only seen on the street corner in prayer, but that prayer went on and on and on and on and on. And they were repeating the same thing over and over and over again, so that people could see really how religious they were, because they prayed for that length of time, and their knowledge was demonstrated because they could repeat the phrase by using a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. We obviously, brothers and sisters, have the same danger. We make open public prayers. Well, certainly the brethren do. And it's very easy to show off one's knowledge in a prayer. It's very easy to use repetitive phrases. That we've heard something which we think, well, that sounds good. I'll use that in my next prayer. We use it in the next prayer, the next prayer, the next prayer, the next prayer. We're not praying genuinely and sincerely unto God. We're praying for the maximum effect, so people can say, that was a good prayer, brother. Thank you very much. Now, at the end of the day, God knows our hearts, and that's what we're going to come on to. Your Father, in verse 8, knows what things you have need of before you ask him. Some people have the ability to express themselves publicly, very eloquently. Others stumble over their words. To the Father, it's what is sincere, what is genuine, that matters. And the brother who is an eloquent Tertullus, who uses the pet phrases and uses quotation for the maximum effect, so people think, oh, what a wonderful prayer that was. He might be the most insincere, might be the one who has done it to get the praise of men. And Jesus is saying, it's totally wrong. Now again, we have an instance, which sadly is sometimes the case, where brethren use deliberately the amount of length of time they pray to the maximum effect. They feel that if they pray for a long time, it will demonstrate how good the prayer is, and they haven't missed any facet of the prayer out. Now, I think we've got to come back, first of all, to the words of the wise man. Can we come back to Ecclesiastes in chapter 5? Verse 2. Be not rash with thy mouth, let thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth, therefore let thy words be few. Let thy words be few. And I think the brevity of the Lord's Prayer underlines that. That we can be heard for our much speaking. And we think that if we go on and on and on, God's going to more accept the prayer that we offer. It's a fallacy. And not only so, it is in opposition to what his will is. Now, we had a sad case, which we know to, where a brother was giving thanks for the food. People were assembled at his house for Sunday lunch. And everybody'd had their lunch served out, and is normal, the brother offered thanks for the food. And everybody got their meal in front of them on the table, except him. And he went on 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes in his prayer, he got his out of the oven so that it was nice and warm. And there is a danger that when we are giving thanks for food at a fraternal, for argument's sake, we can talk about everything and anything apart from giving thanks for the food. And the Master wants us not to be caught up with this effect before men. And the whole object of Matthew chapter 6 up to verse 18 is that we are not doing it for the praises of men. We are not doing it for effect. We are not doing it to impress people with our knowledge. We are not doing it so that others might think what a wonderful brother or sister they might be in the righteous acts which they perform. That, he says, is what the hypocrites do it for. They have their reward. And the seriousness of the situation is, if we receive the reward today, the motive is wrong, and therefore we shall not receive the reward of our Father. Therefore, in verse 6, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet. And when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret. And thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly. Now, how can we apply that in verse 6 to ecclesial prayers? How can we genuinely say, well, you know, we can't pray at all then, because if the only way we can pray is to enter into thy closet? I think we understand the principle. We're doing it there in verse 6 so that it is not seen of others for effect. There are occasions when we have to pray openly. But again, we're doing it to the glory of God and not to impress others for ourselves. And therefore, he says, at times, he says, when you can, ensure that you do these things. Can we go back to the 1st of Kings in chapter 4? 1st of Kings chapter 4. Remember the time of Elisha? 2 Kings chapter 4, sorry. 2nd of Kings in chapter 4. You remember the woman of Shunem who'd paid him great kindness, and in reward for her kindness, he asked what he could give, and she requested a child, and a child was given unto her and to her husband. And then one day the child was in the field with the father, and he died. And the woman left the dead son there and went to find Elisha. And we find that as he comes in verse 33 of 2 Kings 4, verse 32, when Elisha was come into the house, behold, the child was dead, and laid upon his bed. He went in therefore and shut the door upon them twain and prayed unto the Lord. He went in, shut the door, quietly, unassumingly, without any effect, with no ranting and raving. He prayed unto God, and his prayer was answered. Now we've got two great contrasts I'd like you to think about. Remember when Elijah, his forerunner, was upon Mount Carmel? When there's a contest between who was the great God, Yahweh or Baal. And they have to pray unto their God to see who would send fire down from heaven. And the prophets of Baal prayed for 6 hours, ranting and raving and screaming and cutting themselves with knives and doing everything possible to get their God to answer their response. Elijah, very calmly and quietly said, to prove there is a God in heaven, send down fire. And God answered him. The one was heard through their much speaking. The vain repetitions were painfully obvious. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man will avail much. The second point I'd like you to think about is in verse 29 of this 2 Kings 4. After the woman had come to Elisha, he sends his servant to Gehazi in verse 29 saying, "Gird up thy loins, take my staff in thine hand and go thy way. If thou meet any man, salute him not, and if any salute thee, answer him not, and lay my staff upon the child." And in verse 31, Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff upon the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Wherefore he went again to meet him and told him, saying, "The child is not awake." Why wasn't Gehazi's prayer answered? Why, what he did, was it not sufficient to raise the child? I would suggest to you, brothers and sisters, God had no respect for Gehazi. He did it and laid the staff upon the face of the child, and God knowing all things, if that child had been raised, who would have taken the praise? Who would have taken the glory? Because only one chapter later, when we come to Naaman, and we find that Elisha cures Naaman of his leprosy, Naaman wanted to shower upon Elisha all the gold and the silver and that, and Elisha would have none of it. But Gehazi, his servant, runs after him and says, "Well, I'll have it." And he takes it from Naaman and goes back to the Elisha. And of course, he was smitten for leprosy because of it. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man will be answered by God. Gehazi was not normally a man of prayer. He had not committed his ways unto God. He had not sought him humbly. Everything that Gehazi was doing was for effect, so that he might have the praise of men. And his prayer was not answered. Elisha, in the quietness of the room, with no one else there to listen to, but the woman and himself, gave God the glory.